Good day. This is Dimitri Lascaris coming to you for Reason to Resist from Athens, Greece on January 21st, 2025. Those of us who rely on the alternative media to keep us informed about international affairs hear a lot from experts who come from either the United States or Western Europe. In fact, geopolitical analysis in the alternative media tends to be dominated by Western voices. On Reason to Resist, we aspire to do things differently. We seek to prioritize the voices of those who come from the regions that we talk about. And so, for example, our extensive coverage of the wars in West Asia features commentary and analysis from people who come from Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, Iran, Iraq, and so forth. And it's in that spirit that we welcome today, with great pleasure, Alon Mizrahi. Alon is an Arab-Jewish writer and activist who left Israel over the genocide. I came to know about Alon by following his commentary on X, where he eloquently and passionately defends the human rights of Palestinians, while criticizing the Israeli government and Zionism itself. Thank you so much for joining me today, Alon.
Thank you for having me, Dimitri. Pleasure to be Alon, here.
Thank you. Since this is your first time on Reason to Resist, I thought I'd start by asking you to introduce yourself to our audience and tell us about your background.
Well, I grew up as an Israeli, and I don't use this word anymore. I mean, basically just today I decided I'm not going to use this word anymore because I stopped recognizing the state of Israel. But this is personal. I grew up as an ordinary Israeli in a working class town, a small town in northern Israel. My father was a worker. I went to school in Israel, a series of schools in Israel, because I never quite fitted in. This is, again, part of my personal journey. I went to military service at 18, like all Jewish Israelis, and some Druze and Bedouin Israelis also do. I went to work, I went to school, I had my bachelor's degree in English language and literature some 20-something years ago. And I was into philosophy and intellectual understanding of the world and reading, and I was always very curious about stuff, but I never had the occasion or the stimuli to doubt or question Zionism and Judaism in terms of the formal acceptable story. It took me a long time to do this. I began my journey. Israel directs you to nationalism. And also, if you're a Mizrahi Jew, an Arab Jew, and we can talk about this in a second, but especially if you're a Mizrahi Jew, an Arab Jew, and you're decultured basically from your communities, the old communities of Arab Jews who lived throughout the Middle East and the Arab world and beyond. Once this group has entered Israel or was forced or pushed or coaxed into joining the Zionist project, they have been made to almost completely forget and renounce their communal old sense of identity and political story and all of it. So this made them and us, because I'm still part of this group, very susceptible, very fragile in terms of, because when you don't have a strong sense of identity, who you are, what you stand for, it is very easy to mess with your mind, and especially if you come from a stronger, more dominant culture, which is usually the white culture, mm-hmm. which in Zionist terms and Israeli terms, it's white Jews, European Jews, Ashkenazi Jews. So when you're part of this group, you're directed to accept and embrace the Zionist perspective of Jewish existence, of the world, of the Middle East, without any doubt, because you don't have the privilege of doubt. You are there as a client. You are not there as a stakeholder, as a Mizrahi Jew.
Can we just pause there for a second? For the benefit of people who aren't familiar with this term, yeah. I am, but How would you define a Mizrahi Jew? What does that mean to you?
Mizrahi Jews, also known as Arab Jews, are Jews who lived in mostly Arab-speaking and Muslim lands. So mm-hmm. basically in the Middle East, and in the Levant, in the Middle East, but also in Afghanistan, for instance. Jews who are brown-skinned usually, whose mother tongue is Arabic or Persian or this group of languages, and don't speak any European language or Yiddish as Ashkenazi Jews spoke. And it is very, from the looks, it's very easy to distinct Ashkenazi Jews from Arab Jews, with the biggest groups. The biggest groups of Arab Jews are Moroccan Jews. This was the biggest group of Arab / Jews from Muslim lands, because Morocco is not entirely Arab. In Iraq, there was a big, major Jewish community. It doesn't exist anymore. In Syria, in Lebanon, there were smaller. In Egypt, there was also a major Jewish community. It doesn't exist anymore.
And in your case, I understand the part of the Arab world from which your family comes was Morocco. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's half correct. My mother was born in Morocco, and mm-hmm. my father was born in Palestine.
Okay. So I interrupt you. You were talking about the status of the Mizrahi Jews in Israel.
Yeah.
So if you could please elaborate on that, I think this is very important.
Yeah, it is very important. It is key to one of the keys to disentangling this and making sense of what's going on and where this could go. So basically, Zionism began as an Ashkenazi venture, as an Ashkenazi. It began in Europe. The first Zionist Congress had no Mizrahi or Arab Jews in it, only Jews from Poland, Ukraine, Russia, and all of that part of the world. Some from Western Europe and Central Europe, but no Jews from Morocco, Yemen, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, all Iran, no Jews from there. So this is a long and complex narrative. I'm going to make it very short and compact for this conversation. And they began the Zionist movement and began moving into Palestine. The problem was there were around like 12 to 15 million Ashkenazi Jews in the world back then, but very few of them wanted to join Zionism. So by 1948, when they finally got the Israeli state, there were very few Jews in it. So they are around 600,000 Jews. And Palestine still was majority Palestinian, majority Arab. So they had to find human resources to fill in the ranks, because Ashkenazi Jews, after the Holocaust and when they could immigrate to the US, which many did, and some to Western Europe, very few were enthusiastic about Zionism and joining this movement. So what the Zionist idea of making up for lost demographic was, let's bring in the Arab Jews. Let's finish the Arab Jewish existence in their native or very old communities, because some communities were centuries or even millennia old. In Morocco, Jews have been present for 1,500 years easy. And in other countries, other places as well. I mean, think about the sense of identity people have when they are rooted in a place for 1,500 years or more. Mm-hmm. This is what they are. I mean, Israel exists 70 something years. It does. It's not even rooted, and it will never be. But when the Ashkenazi Zionists who created this project needed more people, they understood the only way they can get more Jews to join this was to use the Arab Jewish pool. Mm-hmm. So they started bringing in Moroccan Jews, Iraqi Jews, and it was a long story. They only wanted healthy people. So people who were more, and people who are okay financially, they didn't want poor Jews or sick Jews to join Zionism. So they made waves of bringing in Jews from Morocco, from other places. And they did all kinds of nasty stuff to convince Jews to leave their places and join Israel. Terrorism, sabotage, propaganda. They made all kinds of shady deals with local Arab rulers to get the Jews out. And Mizrahi Jews were mostly, I mean, there was nobody left in communities that existed centuries and centuries, and they were all synagogues, old communities, centuries old, with so much cultural background, with so much intellectual work and so much religious work and spiritual meaning, and all of that was just disappeared. In a few years, nothing remained. This is unbelievable. Unbelievable. You can go now to Morocco to just to complete this sentence. Please, you can go to Morocco or Yemen or Lebanon, and there are synagogues. They still exist. Arab never destroyed one of them. All synagogues and cemeteries, and the doors are locked. And Jews used to pray there for centuries, and now there's no one left. And this is because of Zionism.
And I watched with great interest an interview you did with Owen Jones, in which you were talking about the subordinate status of the Mizrahi Jews in Israel today, that they are more or less viewed as lesser citizens by the Ashkenazi population. Is that fair? And is that something that you experience yourself in your life?
Yeah, every Mizrahi Jew experienced it. If you interview a right-wing Zionist, staunch Zionist Mizrahi Jew, they will tell you the same. They will interpret it differently. They don't doubt Zionism, but no one denies this fact. I mean, white supremacy was part of Zionism all along, and it still is. Israel never had a Mizrahi prime minister. Israeli Supreme Court and Israeli academia are dominated by Ashkenazi Jews. I mean, this is still true to this day. But In the early years, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, it was much more blunt. It was open racism. You can't do this. You can't work in this. You can't. So much was blocked. And also geographically, Mizrahi Jews were sent into distant areas of occupied Palestine, basically to hold some part, whole territory, and work for Ashkenazi Jews in kibbutzim and factories which they owned, but not Mizrahi Jews. So there was a class, an overlord class, and a I don't know, you know, client worker right. class.
And you've said, you've been quite critical of Zionism, as I indicated at the outset, you know, I understand that you've gone through an evolution in that regard. And for a while, for much of your life, you might even have characterized yourself as a Zionist. Could you talk to us about that evolution? And in particular, you've expressed the view that Zionism is actually bad for the Jewish people themselves, and how it is that you came to that conclusion.
Well, this subject, which is very personal but also ideological, needs a long conversation in itself. So I'm not sure I can go into the actual details of how this happened, but I know that this happened. This is the important part. It did happen. I did see myself as a Zionist because there was nothing else. There was nothing else. The skepticism in this sense doesn't exist in Israel. It doesn't exist. You don't meet, you never see a post-Zionist or an anti-Zionist. You never see. I mean, you have to find and discover this yourself, and you have to be even open to this possibility to see that and recognize. I spoke with so much hate and disdain about anti-Zionists 12 or 13 or 15 years ago. And this is part of but this is also part of what the Zionist project does, but especially to Mizrahi Jews. Because once you are left with no genuine sense of identity and value, it is very easy to brainwash you into believing that this is the only value you have, Zionism in Israel, because what else do you have? Other than this, you're just an Arab, which is the dirtiest and the most disgusting thing anyone can be in this world, in this deranged Zionist world. So if you don't have meaning and identity the way Zionism defines it, you are left, you are a human animal. Mm-hmm. So you have to stick to it like very religiously.
Mm-hmm. And why did you come to the view that, if I'm accurately characterizing your view, that Zionism is actually bad for the Jewish people themselves?
This process started for me like almost a decade ago. Once I began feeling empathy for Palestinians and seeing myself as an Arab, and not in a bad way, not in a negative way, but in a good and empowering and opening up way, then I started looking at Zionism more critically as what it's doing, what are its messages, what does it tell Jews? And chance had it that over this period, Israel became more and more openly insane and violent. Since 2009 or 10, but especially 2014, the military operation in Gaza back then was, the Israeli society was in a kind of a frenzy, which was scary. Suddenly all the demons which were repressed were brought to the surface, and it was scary. I mean, it was the first time that I saw and we saw right-wing demonstrators chasing people who were protesting in Tel Aviv against the war, chasing them with iron chains to beat them up, follow them to their houses, and the atmosphere, I mean, the religious right, this section of settlers, which was never marginal, but it wasn't central in Israeli culture. It was suddenly took center stage, and they were speaking constantly in those religious fanatic terms, and it actually became scary. And a few years after that, we had the March of Return in Gaza. And the way Israel treated it with snipers, they shot thousands of people. Peaceful protesters, I mean, no Israeli soldier was hurt during these marches. Mm-hmm. And you could see Israel and the Israeli conversation became more and more insane. It became forbidden to even speak of the occupation. The Israeli opposition stopped talking about the occupation. It stopped being an issue. So as I was like unlearning Zionism, Israel became more and more insane. And so these two processes, the one very personal and another very political, happened at the same time. So it was easier for me to see what's going on. But after this genocide began, I started thinking, you need to start speaking about it. You need to start writing about it. And I made a shift I used to write only in Hebrew, only for Israeli audience. But after October 7, actually on the day of October 7, when I was already like fully aware, I was fully aware of where Israel was going, what was happening. And I had the sense that Israel was at a dead end. It wouldn't exist. I don't know if it's in 2 years, 5 years, or a decade, but it was clear to me this was unsustainable in a very major way. But after October 7, I realized I had no one to talk to anymore in Israel. There was no point, because I used to write for a small group of people who understood radical post-Zionism or anti-Zionism and free thinking. People who wanted to remain connected to the world and not be part of the ghetto, which is direct, exactly to your point about Zionism being bad for Jews. Because this is what Zionism did. It, after centuries of being isolated, especially in Europe, but not only in Europe, Jews were isolated partly because of how they chose to live. They have their own religion, only marry within their group, and so on. But Jews came out of the ghettos in some places, in Western Europe, in Central Europe. Jews began gaining their rights as citizens in their societies. And Zionism reversed this process. It took Jews from all those places and put them in one big ghetto and told them, the whole world hates you. They want to annihilate and exterminate all of you. And this is the message for this is what every Israeli kid knows since age 5. And how insane is that? This is what you tell children. I mean, how is this a win over anything and anyone? I mean, this is crazy. But this is what we were taught. They want to, and this is everyone. This is the Greeks, the Spaniards, the Africans, the Arabs, of course. This is the Chinese and Japanese. Everyone hates you. I mean, this is like learned paranoia on an acute level. Mm-hmm. And so this puts you at odds with basically the rest of humanity. But wait a minute. Is this Jewish liberation? How is this liberation? Mm-hmm. This is nuts. Mm-hmm. Jewish liberation was coming on the world stage and telling people, okay, we had a conflicted and often painful history, but we are now opening a new page, and you need to see us basically as humans, just like everyone else. This is not unique to Jews. I mean, women had to go through this process, right? And Muslims are going through this process to this day, and gay people and so many other groups, and black people, and let's not even start with that. Mm-hmm. So, but this is like the normal conversation you would expect from a group which sees itself, and rightly so or not rightly so, it doesn't matter, as marginalized and oppressed or discriminated against. This is the normal path to take, but this is not Zionism. Zionism doesn't say we are normal and equal and just like everybody else. Zionism says we are the lords of Palestine, and which is the Middle East, because the Middle East is Arab and Muslim. So you can't oppress and destroy one group and not have a fight with other people who are very close to this group and see themselves as one with this group on a cultural and religious level and so on. So Zionism tells you, just because you were born Jewish, you have a right to go to Palestine or Israel, and now you're the master of this place. You have the right to ethnically cleanse and steal and kill. And wait a minute. Is this the new Judaism we want? Mm-hmm. So this message of you're at odds, you're in an existential fight with the rest of humanity because you were born Jewish, this is what Zionism tells you. This is not anti-Semites. No mm-hmm. one in the world says, maybe no one is not the right word, but this is so fringe and mm-hmm. it's saying we have to annihilate all Jews. But the Zionism tells Jews, the whole world wants to annihilate you, and you, in order to survive, you need to become so crazy and threaten people with atomic bombs and annihilate and kill and oppress and expand. And I mean, you don't need to be a radical to say, what the hell is this? Is this supposed to be normal? Is this the answer to the Jewish problem? And by the way, this is a big aside. Mizrahi Jews didn't have this paranoia. They didn't feel as isolated and hated by their mother communities, the way maybe Polish and Ukrainian Jews felt. Moroccan Jews didn't, they had no idea they were supposed to feel this hated and threatened. And this, and I have to remind our viewers and everyone, during World War II, Morocco was still colonized by France, which was occupied by Germany. And not a single Moroccan Jew was sent to Auschwitz. Moroccan Jews didn't even, they kind of knew, but it wasn't part of their world that there was a Holocaust going on. They lived their lives normally in Casablanca, in Marrakech, in Paris, in many other cities. No one did anything to oppress them or to do something bad to them. Mm-hmm. During World War II, the height of the Holocaust, Jews in Morocco lived normally, and also in Iraq and Syria and Egypt. Even in Egypt, which was like conflicted if they were going to support the Germans to get rid of British mandate. I mean, this, it was a choice for occupied Arab people. They wanted their liberation. So Arab Jews didn't have this paranoia. And I met my father's family from Tiberias, the Palestinian Jews. They had none of this, this Chuck Schumer mentality. We have to be strong because everybody, and also Jews in other places, this kind of mentality was, and I don't think even all Ashkenazi Jews had it. A certain part of them had this mentality, but I don't think all of them. This is very much a fabricated and installed concept. Mm-hmm. Because I traveled in Europe, and I traveled in Morocco and other places. I never felt that everyone wants to. This is so insane.
Right.
This is so insane.
So, Alon, given that this is what you've described is the prevailing attitude in Israel, and you even gone so far as to say you couldn't find anybody who had an anti-Zionist view, it's really hard to imagine. And as an outsider hearing this, and I've been to Israel and Palestine on numerous occasions, and although I certainly don't know the society as well as you do, I've had this same sense myself. It's very hard to imagine that Israel could come to an accommodation of Palestinian human rights, either by means of a two-state solution or by a one-state solution in which they're treated as equal citizens voluntarily, that they would choose that path, given that this is the prevailing mentality within Israel. And it's always been my sense, I'm very curious to know if you agree with this, that the only way ultimately for Palestinian human rights and the right to self-determination in particular to be realized is for the non-Israeli world to impose that solution on Israel. Do you share that view? Do you think that there is some kind of educational process? And of course, over a period of decades, that could happen. But the Palestinian people, I don't think we should be asking them to wait decades for there to be a sort of evolution in the Israeli mindset.
Right.
So in the near term, is there any way for this to be done without an imposition of the solution by the international community on Israel?
Well, at this point, having witnessed what we have witnessed over the past 15 months and the past decade, my view today is even darker than this. I don't think that even the international community, even if it exists, can impose this solution on Israelis. We are past this point. It won't happen. And the a major complicating factor in this, I mean, Zionism began as it was crazy and inhumane from the beginning. It's not a good idea. It's not a humane idea. It's terrible for Jews, but particularly for Palestinians. Because think about people sitting in Zurich and making plans for the Middle East who have never been there, you know? Who have never been there. They don't speak Arabic. They don't know a single Arab person. They've never been to Palestine. What the hell are you? I mean, this all already puts you in a position psychologically to become disconnected from your humanity. This is colonialism on steroids. So it started out as a bad idea, and it continued as a bad idea because the idea of you had to ethnically cleanse Palestinians to have a majority Jewish state, which the historical link of Jews to Palestine never necessitated, because you could come to Palestine as a migrant and live there, and no one would have kicked you out, because Jews did it throughout the centuries. They came to Palestine and they settled there and they lived there among Arabs, Ashkenazi Jews and Arab Jews. So this idea of domination and controlling and owning and being the sole masters of the land, this is Zionism. It is not Judaism. Judaism is connection to the land. Okay, I get it. I accept it. Jews wanted to go back to Zion and live. You could do it. It's okay. But being dominating other people and kicking them out, and this is the problem. Mm-hmm. So it was problematic from the beginning, but what really drove Zionism and Jews who became Zionists, what I think really drove them over the edge, in terms of not being able to see how dangerous and detrimental this is, and a dead end, because it can't succeed. You can't have a mentality of this is me against humanity and I'm going to triumph. This is stupid. It can't work. It can't work for the US. It certainly can't work for a small country and a small people like the Jews and Israel. But the real poison pill was the international support, and especially American support, which really created such a disconnect for Israelis and for Zionist Jews between their actions and the consequences. Because the US has worked as a shield to completely isolate Israel from any consequence of what it's doing. It's created this bubble. I mean, normally, if you go crazy, a group of people go crazy and go and kill other people and occupy other countries, they get a reaction. People do this to them, and then they say, okay. Or maybe a new generation comes and say, okay, this, we have to end this. We can't go on like this. We need to find a solution. So the war ends and we move to a different phase, and maybe we battle diplomatically, but we don't, like Turkey and Greece. We don't fight and kill people. We have our like differences, but we're past this stage, and hopefully forever Greece and Turkey are not going to war and are not at war all the time. Mm-hmm. But imagine if Greece or Turkey were told by the US, you can do whatever you want to the other side, and we are going to forever make sure that you are not harmed. This would make any country crazy. Because now you have the permission and the encouragement, mm-hmm, to become sadistic, to become crazy, to become murderous, and all the elements in this society, which would normally, I mean, every society has its psychopaths has its sadists. Every society, Israel is not unique in this regard. But what is unique about Israel is that the sadists and psychopaths are protected by the U.S. no less, and the rest of the collective West. So right. this bubble, it has become so hot with insanity. With no, everything is allowed, everything is permitted. Things you can say, you can sit in a bar in Athens and say, we need to kill all this group of people. And you can do it if you're drunk and crazy, but people, I mean, this is not normal conversation right. to have. It is in Israel, it is completely normal. You can sit at any table in Israel, in any restaurant, in any room, and say, we have no other solution but to finish all Palestinians and then order dinner. It's fine. And as a society cannot come back from this. There's a certain, so this is my answer to your question. It can't be imposed externally. My view today is that Israel has to be dismantled. Zionism needs to be discredited and abolished. It can't coexist because coexistence doesn't, it's not within the range of its ideas that it can even grasp. Mm-hmm. So there is no cure anymore.
I've been articulating the view, Alon, very interested to know your reaction to this, that ultimately the way this will end, as horrifying as the last 15 months have been, I nonetheless remain optimistic that there will be a just peace and the Palestinian people will realize, albeit with great pain and suffering, their dream of self-determination. And my prediction, I wish this weren't the case. I wish that the Jewish population within Israel could remain and coexist peacefully and respectfully with their brothers and sisters from the Arabic community and other communities. But realistically, it seems to me that the way this is going to end is there's going to be a massive outflow of Zionist Jews from Israel. Many will leave eventually when they come to the realization, and I think that realization has begun to sink in, that Israel is not a sanctuary for the Jewish people, that it can't actually, the government and the United States cannot protect it from the wrath of those who have been dispossessed. And ultimately, the so-called demographic war, which, you know, we've heard about from Israeli leaders for a long time, is going to be lost by the Zionist Jewish population of Israel, and it will be won by the Palestinians. That's kind of my prediction. Of course, I could be completely wrong. I'm curious if that's the future that you see for Israel.
This is one scenario, and this is the gentle scenario. Because this another scenario is war with Iran, which will devastate Israel and destroy the infrastructure and create so much damage, Israel won't be able to function anymore as a country. So, and this is very plausible. This could happen today. Israel, I am sure, it wants to attack Iran and is going to attack Iran, and the U.S. is going to help it. So, and this could be like this mega event that changes everything drastically within a couple of weeks. And this is not, you know, out of the question. This is very much in the field of possibilities. Right. But the path Israel chose, and this is the distinction I make. I mean, I can see the flaws of Zionism and how bad and detrimental it always was. But there were periods in history where Israel could pause and say, okay, we've done terrible things. We've done the Nakba, okay? But we are going to let go of the occupied territories of 1967 and say, okay, we have done terrible things. We have done the Nakba, but now we are regrouping. We are reaching out a hand and trying to find a just solution. And then this could be a redeeming moment for Zionism. This kind of admission, we have done terrible things, we have been mistaken. But history, if we didn't see things right, and history was this traumatic, and so and so and so on. But now we are making a genuine effort to change. I mean, this there were times when this was possible. I mean, I wouldn't expect a Palestinian expelled in 1948 to ever accept this. But in terms of the big narrative, of the international narrative, in terms of the big story, this may have been a solution. This could work, like 40 years ago. But the Beth Israel chose, now it is facing economic repercussions which are going to be terrible. I mean, just rehabilitating all the wounded soldiers, the destroyed property, expenses related to the war, which hasn't ended. I mean, we are in ceasefire with Hezbollah, and this could end. There's a ceasefire with Gaza, this could end. There could be an uprising in the expansion in the West Bank could lead to an uprising. Again, reserve service, and then no more flights to Ben-Gurion by foreign, and so on, no more business investment, which was like dramatically reduced over this year.
So the Red Sea shipping.
There's the economic path, which is going to be very difficult, whatever happens next, and we don't expect good things. And there's the legal aspect. I mean, many countries disregard this, but the legal action hasn't gone anywhere. I mean, many Israelis who weren't part of the IDF are going to face problems going to other places. I mean, they could extract one or two or seven. Eventually, they're not going to be able to extract one or two reserve soldiers, and it's going to be a huge problem. And there are arrest warrants for Netanyahu and Gallant, and there are going to be more. So economically, in terms of legal, in terms of culture, Israel is done as a brand. It is contaminated. It is radioactive. The elites and establishments in many countries still uphold this fake acceptance of Israel, but on the popular level, no one wants anything to do with Israel or anything Israeli anymore. So economically, legally, culturally, how are they going to overcome this? And especially the group that rules Israel now, it's not even a remotely sane group. It's a messianic, violent, sadistic, lawless group of people. I mean, even the most capable and honest and understanding group of people who were tasked with like rehabilitating Israel would have faced such almost insurmountable challenges. But this group of people that we have and we are going to have, and it's only going to get worse. They're only going to make everything much worse. So there's no future here. There's no future. And I have to add just one more aspect to it. While it has this kind of American support, and while the U.S. is able to support and protect Israel this way, no one guarantees this is going to remain the situation. The U.S. is the empire right now, and it's very powerful in West Asia, but no one guarantees that in a decade from now it's going to be in the same position. The U.S. is facing huge challenges of its own, and if it goes to war with Iran, who knows what the consequences are going to be? So Israel has pushed aside and rejected any. Seemingly sane solution with such violence, when it is in a weakened position, when it is not in the dominant position, how is it going to handle things? Now it's able to dictate almost everything through the US and through Europe, but when it doesn't have that, what is it going to do? It's going to be so much more difficult.
Right. This has been a fascinating discussion, Alon. I would like to very much have you back onto the program as this ceasefire unfolds to talk about the internal politics of the situation in Israel today and how that's impacting the ceasefire, and continue talking about the future of this conflict with you. So I hope we can have you back on to Reason to Resist, and I greatly appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Dimitri. It's been a pleasure. I feel like I've talked a lot, but it's interesting.
We could go on for hours, and I'd love to elaborate on some of these points. And also, we didn't really spend much time today talking about the internal politics of the situation. I really like to do that as well. So,
let's do that.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
For the time being, we'll pause our conversation and continue at a later date. And I'm coming to you again from Athens today on Reason to Resist on January 21st, 2025.